Okay, so session three, I call this Authenticating the Bible Part 2. We're going to continue where we left off last week. We left off, we went through, what does the creation story tell us about God, the character of God? And then we spent a lot of time on day four of creation. We kind of skimmed across days one through three, went straight into day four because day four tells us so much about the character and nature of God. If you remember, it shows us, just demonstrated his immensity, that his being is so large and so it just simply exceeds human comprehension, that a being could be more powerful and more immense than the universe itself. And then we walk through the concept of energy. What is energy, and where does it come from, and how it demonstrates the immensity of God. I put an unusual slide in at the end of the presentation showing a nuclear weapon being discharged in a test. And we saw the destructive power of that weapon, and closed with the thought that a nuclear weapon, the destructive power that it has, can take out an entire city. And yet it is a pinprick. It is exponentially smaller in power compared to the creator of the universe. Amen? Okay, so let's get started. We will start, before we get back into the actual days of creation, I wanted to walk through some, these are called classical, they're called classical proofs for the existence of God. I don't like the way that is phrased. I rather like classical arguments for an intelligent designer. And we're going to walk through these really quick. There are three primary, what are called classical arguments for the existence of a designer, an intelligent designer. And the first is cosmological, the cosmological argument. And this essentially is based on the fact that logic and our sensory experience, what we experience in the world, that all things, nothing moves or begins to exist unless it has a cause. The law of causality, the law of cause and effect. So in other words, when you walk out and you see a fully functional car there, the car did not create itself, correct? There was a mind that acted on resources such as different metals and rubbers, wiring, acted on those resources, and then there was an effect, which is an operational car. And so things, particularly order things, don't appear on their own. Now, how does this apply to the universe? Because some people say, well, yeah, what we see in this world, what we see, things that we make and we produce, of course they have a cause, but we can't apply that to the universe because energy has always been there, stars have always been there, the universe is eternal. What's wrong with that argument? Anybody want to take a guess? What is wrong with the argument of an eternal universe? The universe has always been there. What? There's no purpose, yeah. But what I'm actually saying is false, correct? The universe did have a beginning, right? Because we talked about the proofs of that last week, about it's expanding. And if something is expanding out and becoming bigger and further away, that means you can rewind it to a point where it had a beginning. And that really threw people like, as I said, people like Albert Einstein and most of the, what you call atheistic scientists of his time, it threw them off because it was easy to believe that the universe was eternal until they figured out it wasn't. It had a beginning. And the law of the cosmological argument, the law of cause and effect, says that which has a beginning must have had a beginner. Something launched it, something created it, something set it off, because things just don't set off by themselves. We see some proofs in this, because if the universe were indeed eternal, what does, you remember what the second law of thermodynamics tells us? The law that has no exceptions? What's that? That's true. But that it's also that energy is winding down. We're always going from order to chaos. It's always winding down. So if the universe were eternal, its energy and matter would be infinitely dispersed. In other words, we have an expanding universe, right? If it were expanding forever, there'd just be nothing left because it would be scattered all over. But it's not. It's still in order. If the universe was eternal, it would be completely run down. In other words, energy would have essentially run down from its usefulness in creating heat and life, and it would be dead because it would be out of energy, but it's not. And because time, space, and matter had a beginning, the cause must be outside of all three. So in the beginning, there was no time, space, or matter. They were all created when God said, let there be. And so God himself is outside of time and space and matter. What does that say about God? Well, obviously, he's immense and has great power. Now, that's the first classical argument. It's called the law of causality or the cosmological argument. The second is teleological. Teleological, which simply means purpose. Purpose. Purpose and design are products only. Can you hear me? Okay. Purpose and design are products only of mind. The universe shows purpose and design. Therefore, a supreme mind exists. Purpose and design are products only of mind. The universe shows purpose and design. Therefore, a supreme mind exists. And this essentially goes along, there's three parts of this argument. The first is, we discussed it last week, the arguments from fine-tuning, the anthropic principle. Does anybody remember the anthropic principle? We walked through several elements of the anthropic principle, which essentially is the universe is fine-tuned to support life. The laws of physics are like if you had 1,000 dials with 10 numbers on each dial, each one would have to be set to the exact right number for everything to work properly. If the laws of physics were suddenly to adjust at the tiniest minute degree, life as we know it would cease to exist. That's called fine-tuning, the anthropic principle. There's the second one, arguments from irreducible complexity. Does anybody know what the argument of irreducible complexity? What is irreducible complexity? Yes, brother. Yep, exactly. What he's saying is that when you go into the cell and you see something as simple as a bacteria, for example, there's a bacteria called I can't remember the name of the bacteria, but it's called a flagellum, and it's like a little tail on the end of it, which gives it its momentum, its movement. And he mentioned the mousetrap theory. Essentially, how well does a mousetrap work if it's missing a part? It doesn't work at all, does it? One part. Something as small as a spring, it doesn't work. So the question has to be asked of the evolutionists, how did things come to function if they had to evolve to gather the parts for them to work? And what we call of irreducible complexity essentially lists, let's go down to the most simplest structure in life, simple bacteria. Can it function without all its parts? No, there was never a time where this organic life could function if it had to borrow parts through evolution. And that's how they get around it. They say, well, parts just borrow from other parts. Well, here's the question. How did the part know which part to borrow from the other part? You know what I mean? Unless someone is guiding the borrowing of one part from another. That's called irreducible complexity. The third argument within the teleological, the arguments from information theory, which is DNA coding, and we're going to get into that when we get into the creation of plants and animals. So again, the teleological argument is this. Because the universe shows complexity of design, shows purpose, things are always moved toward a climax. For example, an acorn becomes a tree. Everything moves toward a directed goal. and operates within a specific pattern. It shows design, therefore it must have a designer. The third is the moral argument. If God doesn't exist, objective moral values don't exist. Objective moral values exist, therefore God exists. What is an objective moral value, and what makes it different from a subjective moral value? Yes. All humans have an intrinsic understanding of what morality is. In other words, if you go across cultures, as Brother Kim said, if you go from what we consider the higher cultures, which would be used to be America, and then you go into a less advanced culture such as the Amazon rainforest, typically every human being has this sense of right and wrong. And because that sense of right and wrong exists, there must be something outside of our senses that establishes right and wrong. And that's objective. In other words, we all know intrinsically, we don't have to be told, if we're sane, that it's wrong to walk across your yard and shoot your neighbor in the head because you like a large screen television. Right? We know that's intrinsically wrong. And every human being that is sane knows that's wrong. But when we get into what we call subjective morality, where you say, you know what, I don't believe in objective morality. I believe that every individual establishes his own morality. Well, now you have a problem. Because remember what Judges said, every man did what was right in his own mind? That's what you get into. So it's moral for me, if I like your large screen TV, I think it's perfectly moral to come over and shoot you in the head and take your TV because it makes me happy. Okay, so there is a sense in the world of a higher law that we're all accountable to. That is the argument, the moral argument for the existence of a designer. So when we combine these three, what we can simply say is this, that inanimate, mindless objects don't direct themselves toward a goal. They don't strive to change upward to get better, and mindless objects, mindlessness, cannot create complex systems. There is no purely chemical or gravitational process by which complex structures can arise. This was an argument of Stephen Hawking. Is everyone familiar with Stephen Hawking? He was the most famous physicist who ever lived, probably. In a wheelchair, had to have an electronic device to speak. Brilliant man. But he wrote a book where he essentially said that the universe doesn't need God because we have gravity. Because now that we understand gravity and know how it works, the universe can and necessarily will create itself. And I like what John Lennox said. He said, that's nonsense. He said, even when a genius speaks nonsense, it's still nonsense. He said, dismissing the creator because we understand how gravity works is like saying we dismiss Henry Ford because we know how the car works. Henry Ford creates the mass production process. We know how the mass production process works, so now we say the mass production process is the creator of the car and dismiss the mind behind it. I like the one where, we see all these movies in Hollywood that come out about computers taking over the world, and it would be funny. It would be like if all the computers that were networked suddenly became self-aware. And the first thing they argued about would be, does Bill Gates exist? You know what I mean? And that's what it's like when humans ask the question, they look at creation and say, does God exist? And interestingly, you know, these three arguments are attributed to people in the medieval era, Thomas Aquinas, for example, 1600s. But there was a fellow, we've already been introduced to him, who had something to say about this 2,000 years ago. Remember Philo of Alexandria? He was a Jewish historian, and he lived in Alexandria, Egypt, which at the time was the center of learning in the world. So he probably had a classical Hebrew and Greek education. So very smart man, very intelligent, and had access to the writings of Aristotle and Plato. And you can see in some of his philosophy that he was influenced by Greek, by the classic Greek culture. Here's what he said, again, writing 2,000 years ago. For some men, admiring the world itself, rather than the creator of the world, have represented it as existing without any maker and is eternal. But Moses, who had reached the very summits of philosophy, remember, Moses wasn't just an ignorant shepherd. Moses grew up in the royal household of Egypt, so he probably was well-educated in engineering, in astrophysics that they had of the day. And the Egyptians accomplished great feats of science and construction. So Moses probably had access to that education, and he also sat at the feet of the creator of the universe. And so Moses obviously was well-versed in what was true, scientific, and right. And he says, but Moses, who had early reached the very summits of philosophy, and who had learnt from the oracles of God the most numerous and important of the principles of nature, was well aware that it is indispensable that in all existing things there must be an active cause and a passive subject. In other words, the way the universe works is there's always a resource, a creator acts upon the resource, and then creates the effect. That's just the way life works. While the passive subject, that which is operated on, is something inanimate and incapable of motion by any intrinsic power of its own, but is set in motion and fashioned and endowed with life by the great intellect, it becomes transformed into that most perfect work, this world. And those who describe it as being uncreated do, without being aware of it, cut off the most useful and necessary of all the qualities which tend to produce moral character. For reason proves that Father and Creator has a care for that which has been created. For the Father is anxious for the life of his children, and a workman employs every device imaginable to provide everything which is useful or profitable to them. So this guy writing 2,000 years ago summed up all three of the laws. I don't know if you noticed that, but what did he say? He said, everything has a beginning. Everything that has a beginning must have a beginner. And then, interestingly, he says, those who reject this idea, those who reject the law of causality, cut off the most useful and necessary qualities which tend to produce moral character. So he links the first two arguments to the third. In essence, what is he saying? What do you mean if I don't believe in the law of causality, that I cut off that which is necessary for moral character? Anybody? Yes.
And it's even spelled out clearly in the Hebrew, in the Psalms it says, you know, and we, in English we get it, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God, but in Hebrew it specifically says, the fool has said in his heart, no God, turning his back on God. And that word for fool, Nabal, is moral reprobate. So it's not just being ignorant or stupid, but it has to do with morality.
Absolutely. Well said. Well said. Essentially, what you believe drives behavior. Amen? And you go all the way back to the very beginning. What you believe about the origin of the universe will drive your behavior. You want to see what somebody really believes? Watch how they behave. Just watch TV for a few hours. You'll see a worldview. Everything you see on television, arts, entertainment, it all has a worldview behind it. What do they believe about the beginning and the meaning of life? And Brother Kim brought up an interesting phrase. What was it you said about the fool? He who says there is no God is a fool, essentially?
Well, yeah, so in Hebrew, if you were to directly transliterate it, it's the fool has said in his heart, no God, saying no to God.
Okay.
Not just that there's no God, but it's like that you're turning your back on God.
It's a willful choice to look at the evidence and say no. Yeah. Absolutely. That's a great lead into, I want to read you something. And see if any of you can recognize who actually says this. Okay, so this is in reference to the law of causality, the idea that the universe needed cause and effect or something to start it. So causation describes the relationship between two separate things, where one thing X causes another thing Y to occur, which is called cause and effect. Okay, I made a mistake. This is not a direct quote. What I'll do is I'll read this paraphrase and then see if anybody recognize it. This particular philosopher challenged the assumptions about causality in his writings. His view of causation played into his understanding of knowledge as being derived from the senses. This person saw causation as a relationship between two impressions or ideas in the mind. He argued that because causation is defined by experience, any cause and effect relationship could be incorrect because thoughts are subjective and therefore causality cannot be proven. Simply put, this person was skeptical of causality. He believed causality was not necessarily empirically sound because it is the subjective mind that assumes there's a cause and effect based on the past. Did you get all that? Were you able to navigate all that gobbledygook? So what he essentially says is this: because this law of cause and effect, the things that we see causing and the effects of the cause, he says, all that is seen and observed by the human mind, so we can't trust it because we could be wrong. He says, it has to be empirical evidence. You have to be able to put it in a test tube. You have to be able to put it on a Brunson burner. It's got to be empirical. It's got to be proven. Well, it shows you when you talk about a fool, what do you use to conduct scientific tests to prove something?
Methodology.
Developed by what? The human mind. You can't trust the law of cause and effect because it's derived from the human mind. It has to be empirical, which is derived from the human mind. So you can't trust the law of cause and effect because we don't trust the mind, but you can trust empirical evidence because it comes from the human mind. Is that not contradictory? It sounds like a child arguing with a child.
Yeah.
What's that?
Be without excuse,
exactly. So this was, by the way, is the philosophy of two famous British atheist philosophers, David Hume and Bertrand Russell. Some of you may have heard of them. They're part of a group of 19th century, late 1800s, English scientists and philosophers. Darwin was among their number. And essentially what they did was they didn't like the idea of being accountable to a higher moral authority, so they set out to develop a philosophy and a science where you could get a universe without God. And that's what Darwin set out to do. I have a saying, evolution did not drive the scientists to atheism, but rather atheism drove the scientists to evolution. So it wasn't the science that led to their evolution, but rather it was their atheism that led. You all got it, okay? They were looking for something. And when you're looking for something, when you have a preconceived idea of what you want to find, you're gonna cram all the science and manipulate it to get there. The real problem is they don't like these first two arguments because they really don't like the third. They really don't like the third. Let me read something to you. Our willingness, this is from evolutionist Richard Lewontin. Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. Did you get that? It's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create a scientific apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive or how mystifying they are. So in other words, commonly you'll hear people like in debates, when you get an atheist versus a Christian or an intelligent design advocate, and one of the charges they always throw at us is that you believe in magic and fairy tales. One of their own just admitted that they believe in magic and fairy tales. Okay. And he closes his quote saying, "Moreover, materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." And why is that? See, in true science, science means is defined by the search for truth. The investigation of what we see and hear to find truth. And science, the process of science, it is, if it is objective and true, you go where it leads you. Wherever it goes, you go with it. But they've reversed it. They take science where they want it to go.
False science and true science. True science proves the Bible is true.
It does. It sure does. Yep. Because the Bible is the first science book. If you read Genesis correctly, it's the first book of science. Okay. Here's a good answer to this question. Why would they not allow a divine foot in the door? This is from Aldous Huxley, yet another British atheist philosopher. These men that Huxley, Hume, and Russell, they're really the stalwarts, the foundation of the modern atheist philosophy movement. He says, "I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world, he is concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do just what he wants to do." If the world has no meaning, why is there any reason I can't do what I want to do? For myself, as no doubt for most of my friends, the philosophy of meaningless was essentially an instrument of liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. There was one admirably simple method of justifying ourselves in our erotic revolt. We would deny that the world had any meaning whatever. Boy, do you see that playing out today in the Western culture. Wow. You hear, when I was a kid growing up, probably most of Hollywood were still pagans, but they had a respect for the things of God. And you could see that respect played out in their products on the screen. But today, what they do now is, where you used to hear the word God, you hear the word universe now. I don't know if anyone's ever noticed that. Universe is now the source of all things and the source of wisdom and blessing and whatever. And you see in Western culture, this hostile approach to faith and Christianity, not because they know it's not because they think it's false, but because they want it to be false, because they don't want to be accountable to the God of Christianity. Reprobate mind. Yep. She's talking about the reprobate mind that Paul speaks of in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 31. And what this teaches us is that when you dismiss God, when you say no to God and become a fool, there's no neutrality in this. When you say no to the moral law, it's a downward spiral. There's no, "I'll do a little bit here and there and we'll be a secular, there would be a secular nation." Once you've known the moral law and you reject it, we see what's happening now. It's a dissension into the toilet, essentially. What's that? Progressively worse. Yep. Okay, so we're going to switch gears here, and we're going to return back to the days of creation. Does anybody have any questions or comments on what we just went through? The three primary arguments for the need for an intelligent designer. So now we're going to go in and take a look at the actual work of our Creator and try to use some scientific understanding as we walk through these verses. So verse 1 says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." And we talked about how the language of that particular verse gives us the image of not a finished complete globe with land and water, but rather a giant celestial mud puddle, if you will.
The Bible describes it as...
Hello? Hello? Yeah, okay. The Bible describes it as basically a giant thing of water containing eretz, Hebrew for soil. So what was needed to form the earth was within that giant cloud of water, if you will. And then we look at Genesis 1, 2 through 5, and it starts with, "The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep, and he said, let there be light." Now, if you remember when we talked about the Big Bang, what were some the two most important features that we understand of the Big Bang that were existence was energy and gravity, both of which flow from the Lord himself. And so when we talk about when God moves, it says the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep. And the language there is as if the Holy Spirit is physically fluttering. The word is fluttering over this water puddle. And you can kind of deduce from that is there's an energy transference taking place. In other words, God is transferring a process of energy and gravity into that water to change it, to transform it. Because what is required to transform matter? Energy. Energy. Transform matter. And so astrophysicist Hugh Morris details it this way. He says, as the outflowing energy from God's omnipresent spirit began to flow outward and permeate the cosmos, gravitational forces were activated and the water and earth came together to form a great sphere in space. So gravity and energy moving on the earth to create a sphere. Proverbs 8:24 through 27 states, "When he established the heavens, I was there," speaking of the word of God, "when he inscribed a circle on the face of the deep." When he inscribed a circle on the face of the deep, the process of transforming it into a globe. Has anybody ever heard of the flat earth theory? The flat earth? Yeah. Please tell me there's nobody that believes that in here. the Hebrew for circle, some people translate this, they promote the idea that the earth is a flat circle and it's got a dome over it of an atmospheric dome. The Hebrew can mean a literal circle, but it also means a globe. And the scriptures itself speak of a globe hanging on nothing, is what the prophet says. All right, here's an interesting video I think will illustrate Genesis 1, 2 through 5. Let me know, raise your hand if you're having problems hearing the video, okay?
God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. And let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. And the evening and the morning were the second day. And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place. And let the dry land appear.
Okay, so what you don't see there is the act of a mythical being. In other words, people often accuse Christians of believing in a god that is akin to Zeus or whatever, the Norse gods, whatever, and they just sort of, you know, gather up a bunch of celestial material and hurl it all together and shape it up. But what you see is true science in action. You know, God as the wielder of the laws of physics, he again, he transformed it into a globe. He takes the water, exerts energy upon it and gravity, causing it to some of it to vaporize and to come in and form what is the sky, as we know, where the birds fly. And then it continues to go up, the water vapor, into the atmosphere. And so many creationists believe that at the time of creation, where we see that the waters are separated from the waters, some water remains, of course, on the earth, and then some of it is vaporized and condensed and compressed and rises into the atmosphere, that part that the at the outer reaches of the firmament, you had the water canopy. And it makes perfect sense that there was a thin canopy of water over the earth at the beginning, because we see signs of it, we find proof of it in paleontology and anthropology. If you look at the slide up here, located between the thermosphere and mesosphere, I can't point to it, can I? Yeah, there you go, right there. Now, if you have, it was thin enough to allow a healthy dose of solar energy to hit the Earth, which is important because you need solar energy to live. But it was thick enough to filter out all of the damaging gamma rays that are cancer-causing. Furthermore, it creates what you would say is sort of a natural hyperbaric chamber. If you've ever heard of that, the hyperbaric chambers super oxygenate your blood. Some very wealthy people use it to treat their diseases and to prolong their lives. And so the entire Earth would essentially have been a super oxygenated spa, if you will. We also had uniform tropical temperatures. This is evidenced by the fact that we find tropical creatures and plant life in places like Siberia, which are covered in ice. So you have a distribution of flora and fauna that are from tropical areas, but are actually distributed throughout what are now cold areas. It would have inhibited air mass movements. In other words, no storms. The Bible says that there was no rain in the beginning, but rather the water was, plants were watered by dew that came up from the soil. Filter out radiation, we discussed, increased surface pressure, which is that hyperbaric chamber type effect, and would support large animal life. Yes, Marissa. Which would affect carbon levels, which would affect carbon dating. Yeah, because carbon dating assumes the Earth has always been as it is now. But in the early time, the carbon would have much been thicker, more plentiful because of the amount of living things. Because what is oil made of? Fossils, dead dinosaurs, essentially, and dead plant life. Over time, we had much more at the beginning because it could sustain and support large amounts, large sized and large amounts of life. So, of course, it could support dinosaurs. Dinosaurs. Now, the problem we have here, well, wait a minute, dinosaurs, you believe that dinosaurs existed with men? Well, yeah, because everything was created together. And we actually have evidence that dinosaurs and men coexisted. These are government seals and a variety of ancient jewelry. And as you can see, if you look at this picture, these are not mystical beings, but they are actually animals that reflect the significant and major dinosaur structures. For example, if you look at this one here, where my mouse is, that is a Stegosaurus.
You know the source of that stone? It looks sort of Mayan.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. I knew where it used. I used to know where it come from, but I've been using this for so long I've forgotten. But I will get back to you, Kim, and give you the source. And of course, if you see that in the middle, we have people riding what looks like a triceratops, and then at the bottom you see creatures with the long necks representing a variety of dinosaur species such as Brontosaurus. So these are examples of old artifacts that depict the interactions between men and dinosaurs. And this is probably obviously post-flood. So dinosaurs still existed for a time after the flood, but we're going to talk about this in a minute with the flood. When the flood came, in fact, we'll just go into it and we'll talk about it. Okay, so when God separated the waters and he brought forth the land, all of that water, so he, again, it was exerting transformational energy into the earth, which caused the chemical processes of the soil to harden and separate from the water. And then the remaining water was formed into sea, a giant sea, a giant ocean, and then a lot of it actually went underground into the Earth's crust. Now that's important to know, because when we look at Genesis 7, 11 through 12, which is the account of the flood, the existence of this canopy and the existence of this water located in the Earth's crust is very important to understanding the flood. It says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all of the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of heavens were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. So the rain, the water that flooded the earth, was not just simply rain, but was also a result of all this water that had been placed into the earth's crust as underground underground reservoirs, if you will. The crust burst open and all that water came up in these great fountains. And then, where do you get enough rain to rain for 40 days and 40 nights? Where would you source that from? The canopy that surrounded the earth collapsed. And so, and all of this describes beautifully the current geography of the earth. Because first of all, when the canopy collapses, what did the canopy do? It filtered out harmful solar radiation. So once the canopy collapses, now the atmosphere is thinner, and now what's coming through? Harmful solar radiation now. Harmful solar radiation.
One place, which suggests that in the early Earth, there was one landmass.
Just one continent split up, we believe, during the flood later on.
It wasn't until the 1960s that geologists began to widely accept continental drift, a supposedly new idea that proposed the continents of Earth had broken up at some time in the past and slowly drifted apart. You've probably heard the name Rodinia or Pangaea, supercontinents in which all of the continents as we know them were once connected together. This is a concept that the Bible already revealed thousands of years earlier. In 1858, Antonio Snyder Pellegrini proposed that the continents had moved apart rapidly during Noah's flood in a catastrophic process. Genesis 1:9 states that God gathered together the waters unto one place, and then he made the dry land appear. What the Bible had stated all along, that the lands were once connected and then split apart, geologists started teaching thousands of years later.
Many people's understanding of the flood is the understanding they acquired when they were about 4 years old. The flood was an incredible catastrophe, almost beyond what the human mind can comprehend.
This is a catastrophic event of unimaginable proportions. Sedimentation on a global cataclysmic, catastrophic scale, burying billions of creatures suddenly in unimaginable amounts of sediment. Look at all the fossils. It's almost like the surface of the earth screams at us, hey, there was a catastrophic event.
If something like that happened, what sort of evidence should that have left behind?
Billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth.
Most of the fossil record is a result of the flood, not millions of years of slow processes.
The fossil record documents the reality of the Genesis flood. It was also a tectonic catastrophe, large-scale plate motion, migration of the continents by thousands of miles, which means that all the Atlantic Ocean opened up during the flood. The Indian Ocean opened up during the flood, transformation of the Earth's surface.
It is impossible to walk away from the text thinking that this was some type of local Mesopotamian flood. This was a flood of universal proportion in its destruction of the earth itself, its destruction of all mankind.
The Bible tells us of a worldwide flood that radically changed the climate and devastated the continents thousands of years before scientists would even propose ice ages. The irony being that these same scientists would confirm the possibility of great global floods on planets like Mars, and yet still deny a global flood was possible on Earth. You see, the Bible already stated there was a worldwide flood, and they don't want to validate the Bible. They'll come up with any other explanation but the truth.
For 150 days, the waters covered the mountains. They prevailed over the earth. 5 months of torrential downpour rain, of the fountains of the great deep being broken open and gushing out water from beneath as well. The Tahoma Rabbah, the great deep, which immediately takes the reader back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, where we have a water-covered earth.
Okay, so it's interesting. He said, what would you expect if we had a giant global flood, billions of dead things arranged in sedimentary layers, just as we find them? Now, the impacts of the flood, again, we see the providence, the direction of the Lord. So he has the two sources of water ready because he's knowing what's coming. And then what is the result of the fountains breaking up? Tectonic plates. I'm going to go backwards, actually. I'm getting ahead of myself. So when I mentioned before, when the canopy collapsed, we have solar radiation now pouring onto the earth at a much higher level than it was before. One negative, because God said, listen, these men, they're living for hundreds of years. And in hundreds of years, they're magnifying evil. So he said, I'm not going to keep contending with them for this long. So what happens after the flood is this: the solar radiation begins to mutate the cells of men. And what changes? The age. If you look at the chart, many of you have probably seen this before, but in Adam's time to Methuselah, men could live as long as nearly 1,000 years. But immediately after the flood, you see the rapid decline of the lifespan of human beings. And why is that? Because we are now being bombarded with mutating solar radiation. In fact, we've mutated so much since the flood that one philosopher said, it's only by mutual consent that we call each other normal. Yes, in the back. Yes, if I understand what you're saying, so you have the solar radiation increasing, but you also have the loss of what we call that hyperbaric effect. In other words, it was that hyperbaric effect that kept the Earth super oxygenated, kept it warm and moist, and the tropical temperatures across the globe. So if all of that collapses, and suddenly the earth is thrown into different temperature zones, you don't have the huge oxygen levels, plants begin to decline in size, what else has to follow? The animal life changes. The dinosaurs disappear because they can no longer be sustained in this new environment. Yes? Well, while he's in the ark, yeah, okay, so it's raining, and then the raining stops, and I think it's roughly a year before the waters recede. So he lives, how long does he live? 950 years. So I don't know how much longer he lived after the flood itself, but we see Shem lived 600, so his son had a life expectancy of 300 years less. So it's already taken effect. So Noah, maybe not so much. You know, we don't know how old he was when he went into the ark. But immediately, his son lives 300 years less. It's already taken effect. In the video, we talked about the other cataclysmic effects of the flood. We see the picture to your right. When you look at the design of the land masses, you can tell just by looking at them that they would form a puzzle at one point, the way that they would interlock if you brought them together. And so in the process of the fountains of the deep breaking up, the Earth's crust cracked and was broken into the different tectonic plates on which the continents sit. And this created a long-term problem because what do plates do? They move and they shift and they often run into each other. And when they run into each other, one goes under the other and it creates a ripple effect. And it creates volcanic explosions because the crust has opened up and you have lava flowing to the top into volcanoes. And it also creates these giant earthquakes. And it also creates killer tsunami waves. And so the judgment upon mankind didn't stop at the flood. It was something that God allowed to echo throughout time, essentially to keep man at bay and to remind them that he's in charge. Okay, in the and to the left the picture, that's the Grand Canyon. We see in the geology of canyons proof of a giant and quick alteration in the topography of the earth. And you can see in these canyons, you know, you see the different sediments that have built up. It's not just solid rock, but it's layers of sediment that would be formed by a flood churning the soil and minerals at the bottom of the ocean. And then in the third picture, we see the Ice Age. So what happened during the flood, as the fountains blew up, the sun was blocked out for at least for 40 days, 40 nights at a minimum. And so the earth cooled. And in the northern regions on those plates, you had ice take over. And it brought about the Ice Age. So that was another side effect of the flood. All right, as Marissa mentioned, when we talk about effects of the flood, we see this, the fossil record. Scientists will point to the fossil record and say that it indicates it's millions of years. When we look at amber fossils that are littered throughout the fossil record, we find that amber is below the dinosaurs. And these amber bits that I have up here for you are estimated to be 99 million years old. And amber is formed when tree resin, when you damage certain trees, it'll emit a resin that's essentially a bandage for itself. And amber hardens upon contact with air and preserves anything caught in it. There are spectacular fossils entrapped in a Burmese amber, Burmite, located in Burma, located near coal deposits. These deposits carry the signs of a major flood. Burmese cowrie trees with the resins containing animals were torn apart and buried rapidly in a flood. Intense pressure caused by the density of the sedimentary rock and heat turned tree parts to coal and resin to amber. Okay, so these are three examples of the amber found at this deposit. Now, I want to ask you a question. What do you see in these bits of amber that are 99 million years old? You see whole animals preserved quickly in an instant. And what kind of animals are they? What's this little fella here on the right here? What is that? That ain't no dinosaur. You see these guys crawling up your wall all the time here in Hawaii. Huh? To the right. A gecko. It's a little gecko. And what do you see to the left of the top? You see a typical spider eating something. And then to the bottom, you see the modern mayfly. These are modern creatures trapped in amber that are supposedly 99 million years old. We go back to the comment, the quote by the atheist. We accept all kinds of absurdities in science because we can't let a divine foot in the door. When the evidence is staring them in the face, they say no to God. Okay, so now we move into days, the days of creation of living things, days 3 through 6. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth, and it was so. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth after their kind. So we will take a break for a few minutes and come and talk about living things. All right, folks, we will get started. So we are in the days of the creation of living things. So living things are comprised of what we call inorganic material. In other words, the resources within the soil itself. And so God takes this inorganic material, if you will, and he puts life into it. It creates living things, the plants and the animals and human beings. So the biggest difference, obviously, between a living thing and a non-living thing is DNA. DNA. DNA is a programming language that takes the structures that God built out of the soil itself, because the Bible, you know, the Bible says that he made man from the dust of the earth. From dust you came, and from dust you shall return. So without God breathing life into us, we are merely lumps of clay. So he, again, breathing into us life, he also puts into us a programming language that directs the operation of our cells. That is what makes us living, operating as living things. It's DNA, and it guides the genetic processes, and the genetic processes are what dictate what we look like. So a plant has one set of genes that make it a plant, that make it a fern or a tree or a rose. Humans have genetics that make some of us large, some of us tiny, some of us less annoying than others, okay? So we're gonna do a discussion on evolution and genetics here. So the first picture I have is the Bible emphasizes in all, when it talks about animals and plants, is kinds. Let's go back to that previous slide. So let the earth bring forth grass, the herb and the yielding seed after its kind. And then let the earth bring living creatures after their kind, crap, cattle, and creepy things after their kind. And also, what I don't have on here are the created on the same day were the birds and the animals of the sea, which were also brought forth after their kind. And so what do they mean by kind is genetic programming at what we call the family or genus level. So all animals and plants are locked in into their kind at what we call the genus level. And there can be no mating outside of that level. So here we have the genus of canine or canidae, and that is the wolf. And you see in the chart that all of the dog breeds that we have today originated from the wolf. And so evolutionists will point to that and say, well, see, that's evolution, right? So you have the wolf, and then you have all of these breeds of dogs coming forth from the wolf because their genes are mutating, they're changing form, they're changing size, and they're changing species. Now, does anybody know what the problem with this is when you look into it? Yes, Kim. Absolutely. Ken Ham, with Answers in Genesis, he looks at the wolf and then he looks at the little toy poodle. And he uses the toy poodle as an example of de-evolution. In other words, the poodle is about as low as you can get on the scale. And as Brother Kim said, what all these breeds are forced genetic mutation, not by nature, but by who? By men. Men force the change. They force the mutations through selective breeding. And as Kim said, what essentially happens is that all of these original animals that came together in their kind, the wolf, for example, had all of the genetic material required to reproduce these diversity of breeds. In other words, the wolf is the ultimate genetic container, if you will. It has all the DNA and all of the genes to provide all of the diversity within the dog kingdom. Does that make sense? Adam and Eve were the ultimate carriers of the DNA and genetic material for a diverse human race. And so what happens is when you breed these dogs to get these purebreds, you are actually losing genetic information. They're becoming lesser of an animal. There's no new information being added, but rather information is being redistributed, changed, and lost. So that's why when you see a German Shepherd, for example, and it's walking with its hind legs dragging because it has hip problems, that's a common mutation that has affected that breed. You know what I'm saying? So the mutation is actually caused a loss of information, which causes the resulting animal to be less efficient, less effective, and less healthy. Look at the pug, for example. Yes, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But the 5% that is lost is huge, absolutely huge amount of information. Yes.
So the dog's a good example of, just like us, the further away we got from the source code, Adam and Eve, the more defects and problems and, you know, anemia mm-hmm. and the other we're having. And so as we're advancing towards a thought of evolution and, you know, even approaching post-evolution, but it's more like we've got examples staring us in the face of how wrong that is, because it's just de-evolving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the breeds of dogs are not an example of evolution, they're an example of de-evolution, the mutation and loss of information. There is no new information added, because true evolution requires the introduction of new DNA information. Something has to happen to tweak the genes, to tweak the DNA, to cause it to produce new combinations of amino acids, which is new information, to create new species. But we see, when we look at the kinds that the Bible refers to, their DNA and genetics are locked in. Even if you breed, for example, a tiger and a leopard, or a lion and a tiger, you can get an offspring, but it's infertile. It will not continue to produce offspring. So even within that family, when you breed two cats, you still can't get a process of evolution where the traits are continued on, because you have violated what God established in terms of kinds. Now, wolves and dogs can mate. But they can't mate with foxes. Foxes and dogs are all members of the same family, but you cannot mate a dog with a fox or a wolf with a fox, because they violate the kinds. Make sense? Okay. Now, what's required for evolution to occur, and evolution is essentially these small, minute mutations of the genetic material creating new information, and they repeat over time. Over time, and eventually enough mutations occur to cause a jump in species, if you will. So if you take, for example, we look at the tree of life. According to Darwin's tree of life, we all started as protoplasm in a mud puddle. And then the protoplasm, advances and grows and goes to snails and different kinds of plants, and then the snails become more advanced, and eventually you get to people and dogs and cats. Okay. Again, new information being introduced. But here's the problem with that. You have to have beneficial mutations for that to occur. Beneficial. New information that actually moves it forward. But this is from nature.com, and this is commonly known within the scientific community. Mutational effects can be beneficial, harmful, or neutral, depending on their location or context. Most non-neutral mutations are damaging. In general, the more base pairs that are affected by a mutation, the larger the effect of the mutation, and the larger the mutation's probability of being damaging. In other words, most mutations that occur in nature, a large percentage of them, most of them, are damaging. I'll give you an example. If you look at this is a duck with four legs. That is a mutation. Is it advantageous? Can the duck run faster? Of course not. Probably can't walk at all, because the mutation has given it has caused it to mutate in a way where it actually will kill the animal if a mind does not intercede. The fruit fly, it mutates, it grows two additional wings, so it has four wings. Can the fruit fly fly? The fruit fly cannot fly with four wings. So again, the mutation does it no favors. And this is the prime example of what happens in nature when things mutate. There are slightly beneficial mutations, but those are already worked into the DNA. When I talk about original DNA in the original animals, because when you look at animals, they do change over time, but that's affected by what? Environment. So, for example, when you had Adam and Eve, and then you have thousands or millions of offspring over time, and they go into different climates. For example, some people go into the hot climates, and the skin over time becomes more brown or even black, depending on the climate. Dogs have thicker fur, or lighter fur. Darwin's finches in the Galapagos Islands, some had thicker beaks to break harder seeds. Some had, over time, had smaller beaks. It's not evolution. It's simply it's simply adaptation, where God has built into the original DNA messaging, if this happens, this happens. That's a common computer code. If this, then this. It does not require evolution or the introduction of new information. Have I lost anybody? Okay, let us then move on. This video, What is DNA? It provides a great demonstration of why DNA, the importance of it, and will give us the foundation for the rest of our discussion on this issue.
Stated Clearly presents, What is DNA and how does it work? DNA, also known as deoxyribonucleic acid, is a molecule. It's a bunch of atoms stuck together. In the case of DNA, these atoms combine to form the shape of a long, spiraling ladder, sort of like this one here. If you ever studied biology or saw the movie Jurassic Park, you probably heard that DNA acts as a blueprint or a recipe for a living thing. But how? How on earth can a mere molecule act as a blueprint for something as complex and wonderful as a tree, a dog, or a dinosaur? To help answer that question, let's first take a quick look at amino acids. Amino acids are tiny little chemicals inside our bodies that are so important, they're often referred to as the building blocks of life. There's about 20 different kinds, each with their own unique shape. The neat thing about them is they can be attached to each other, kind of like Legos, to produce an endless variety of larger particles known as proteins. Amino acids make up proteins. Proteins, along with other chemicals, combine to form living cells. Cells make up tissues. Tissues make up organs. And organs, when they're all put together and functioning, of course, combine to form living creatures like you and me. These proteins that make up our bodies, and keep in mind, there's millions of different kinds of proteins, they each have to be formed in the perfect shape in order to function. If they're the wrong shape, they usually won't work. That's where DNA comes in. DNA does a lot of interesting things, some of which we don't fully understand, but one of its main and most well-understood functions is to tell amino acids how to line up and form themselves into the perfect protein shapes. In theory, if the right proteins are built at the right time and in the right place, everything else, from cells to organs to entire creatures, will come out just fine. This here is a simplified model of DNA. It shows us that the steps of the ladder are made up of four different kinds of chemicals shown here by different colors and letters. If you look at just one half of the molecule, you can read its chemical sequence or genetic code from top to bottom, sort of like a book. A single strand of DNA is extremely long, millions of letters long. It spends most of its life coiled up like a noodle, living inside the nucleus or the centerpiece of a cell. Amino acids, however, live outside the nucleus in what's called the cytoplasm. To help DNA interact with the cytoplasm and convert those amino acids into proteins, special chemicals inside the nucleus make partial copies of the DNA code. These partial copies, called RNA, look a lot like DNA, but they're shorter, of course, and they're missing one of their sides. Their small shape and size allows them to fit through tiny pores in the nucleus, out to the cytoplasm, and into the mouth of another particle called a ribosome. Ribosomes are protein-building machines. They read the RNA code three letters at a time, suck amino acids out of their surroundings, and stick them together in a chain according to the RNA code. As the chain grows, it bends, it folds, and it sticks to itself to form a perfectly shaped protein.
Okay, I wanted to pause it there real quick because so what you have is, again, DNA is in the cell, each cell, and then a copy of the DNA, which is called RNA, comes out of the cell, and it goes into this thing called a ribosome. And then the ribosome, it's like almost like a ticker tape, is going through this little machine, and it's telling this little machine what protein to form, right? And then what does the protein do? Anybody? It makes its way into a shake, and we drink it in the morning after we bodybuild, right? Okay. Now, I want to sear that image into your mind, that you have this instruction, if you will, this set of instructions going through this little machine, and this little machine is making proteins.
Every three letters of the RNA code tell the ribosome which of the 20 different kinds of amino acids should be added next. For example, CAA tells the ribosome to grab a glutamine. AGU tells it to grab a serine, and so on. Once a protein is built, it can then go on to do a number of different things, one of which could be to help form a brand new cell. So to answer the original question, what is DNA? DNA is a molecular blueprint for a living thing. How does it work? DNA creates RNA. RNA creates protein. Proteins.
Okay. So, what does a computer run on? How does a computer work? Do you plug it in and it just works? It's just there and it works? What makes a computer go? Programming, software. The engineer, the software engineer, programs a language which is just basically ones and zeros. I have no idea how it works. But those ones and zeros tell the computer what operations to do. You feed it in there, and it will only do what the programming tells it to do. And so when you look at DNA and you see how its instruction set, its coding, is coming into the ribosome and telling the ribosome to create a specific protein molecule. And then the protein molecule goes off and drives all of your metabolic processes. It may go create a new brain cell. It may go create a new heart cell. It may go in and tell your digestive system to react in a certain way to certain foods. So proteins are what form all of your basic metabolic functions. So do you kind of get the image then that the body, human body, is almost like that computer system? That it doesn't work unless there is this language, this coding that's being fed into it. Does that make sense? Now the question is, where does the coding come from? Can a rock generate language? Will a rock ever speak or say or generate anything of any use? Can a cloud generate language? Have any of you ever talked to a cloud? If you have, please come talk to me. I will get you help. Okay. So DNA is, and I want to address that in a second. So what the evolutionist says is that DNA itself is natural, and that DNA goes out and mutates itself to create the new information needed to move things ahead positively. Now, what I mean by that is this. What DNA would have to do is that it would have to take, so proteins are formed by combinations of amino acids. And so DNA tells the ribosome which combination of amino acids are needed to form a specific protein. Now, to create new information, a new protein, the DNA would have to go out and search billions of possible amino acid combinations that exist in the universe to create that new information. A mindless, unguided, natural entity would have to do a computer search of billions of possible amino acid combinations and do it repeatedly over time. Now, let's look at this. It's called the combinatorial problem. So if you go up to a bicycle, you've forgotten your bicycle has the lock with four dials and 10 numbers on it. You forgot your combination. You cannot remember it. You don't have it written down. So to get your bike open, you have to guess. So if you tried every possible combination, if you worked for 7 hours nonstop, to guess every possible combination, there's 10,000 possible combinations. If you work without taking a break, you could guess it in 7 hours. Trying a new combination every 2 seconds. Now, if you add 10 dials, it multiplies to 10 billion possible combinations. So you would have to work nonstop doing it, trying a new combination every 2 seconds for 799 years. And you have a mind and a brain, by the way. Now with protein, with searching for new amino acid combinations, a mindless cell, if you will, would have to search what is essentially 10 with 77 zeros after it. That's what it would have to do. A mindless cell would have to do the equivalent of trying to find the combination on a bike chain with 10 to 77 zeros possible combinations. Do you understand what I'm saying here? I'm saying it's impossible. Okay, the chances are greater that I will wake up tomorrow with a snake growing out of my head than for DNA to form new information needed to fuel evolution. Does that make sense? Yes, Kim.
And it's even more complicated than that because you're assuming, or you'd have to assume, that there's some intelligence guiding that and remembering every previous attempt at combinations.
Exactly.
It would not happen. So it becomes even more ridiculous and impossible. The other thing too, earlier we were talking about, you know, it's like basically saying chaos creating order, and that violates the second law of thermodynamics. Also, with the computer, it's even more complicated than we're discussing, because there's hardware specifically designed to work with the software, and also an energy source that is compatible with all three. So.
And that goes back to the sort of the theory of the watchmaker. You have all these moving pieces that have to work in conjunction with each other at all times. And they're very complex, at least when you actually had the watches that had parts, and now most people tell time digitally. But as Kim said, life is so complex and requires so many intricate pieces to work together at one time that it's impossible for a mindless process to make it work. And not only does the mindless DNA have to assemble this, again, 10 to the 77 zeros, but they have to keep repeating the process every day, all the time, remembering what they did, finding new ones, stringing them together in a way that works. Where does this number come from? That doing it by chance, that maybe nature could assemble one working amino acid, while 10 to the 77 zeros would be non-functional. So in other words, the process is impossible. Does that make sense? Because it's hard to explain. I'm trying to figure out if I did explain it well. Yes, Kim.
Okay, so, and I'm just repeating, in a sense, what you're saying. So it's like a mindless, thoughtless, purposeless something or other, less than, is always less than God's design for what he had for us.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So the chances are 10 to the 77th power. A 2010 study by molecular biologist Douglas Axe found that if six beneficial mutations are needed to form a minute advantage, a tiny advantage, evolution, in other words, if the six beneficial mutations are needed to form a minute advantage, Darwinian evolution could not create such a trait in the entirety of Earth's history. In other words, this process I talked about, this random process of assembling amino acids, the billions of years that we estimate that the Earth has existed, the universe has existed, is still not enough time to randomly assemble a beneficial protein. So next we'll be told that the universe is actually trillions of years old. Yes.
Fairy tales and myths, but that's the very thing that evolution needs, time, billions of years, this magical property that is elusive, that you can't make sense out of, to, you know, say something that came out of nothing.
Yep. Every time creation makes it, takes a step forward, it creates a problem for scientists in terms of time, what do? They wave the magic wand and increase the amount of age of the universe. Because if you have endless amounts of time, you can accomplish anything, right? Okay.
So, what I want us to understand is this. You can't read the word help without the language. Actually, DNA is like that. You realize that DNA is like all this information, but you know what else? You got to have the language to read DNA, so DNA itself has the information to make the language to read the DNA. It's all got to be there or it won't work. Now, Dr. Werner Gitt, who's a German scientist, he wrote a book called In the Beginning Was Information. And in that book, he says this, there is no natural law through which matter can give rise to information. Now, stop right there for a moment. Life is built on information. Do you know how many bits of information there are in living things on this earth? It's not millions. It's not billions. It's zillions. I mean, it is uncountable for us. The amount of information in DNA on living things on this earth is absolutely extraordinary. Do you know what Dr. Gitt is saying? There's not one instance where matter has ever produced one bit of information by itself. Wait a minute. According to evolution, matter had to produce information over millions of years. You've got to get all this new information to get the zillions of bits of information we have so that you can get all these new features and creatures and all the rest of it. Well, wait a minute. We've never seen matter produce one bit of information. That means life could not have arisen by natural processes. Not only that, he goes on and says this, a code system is always the result of a mental process. Matter by itself never produces a code. You know, if you do computer programming, if you have random events on your code to disrupt the code, it destroys it. And if you just try to generate a code by random processes, it isn't going to work. You have to have a language to make it work. And so you see, when you think about it, What evolutionists believe, they don't just believe that one kind of animal changed into another. They have to believe that matter produces information, and that originally matter produced information and a language system to form life. And over millions of years, you produce more and more information to get the zillions of bits of information. People, you know what this really says? Evolution is ridiculous. It's absurd. No wonder the Bible says, if you don't believe in God, you're without excuse. DNA actually cries out to us, in the beginning God created.
Yeah, he says it much more articulately than I do. Thank you, Ken Ham, for summarizing. This next video I want to show you, this is John Lennox. He is a mathematician at Oxford University. One of my favorite apologists, because he's willing to take on the big guys like Richard Dawkins. And he's going to tell a story here that kind of summarizes what Ken Ham just told us about the miracle of DNA. And it's funny because he has this conversation with an atheist, an ardent atheist. I'll let him tell the story.
The question of the immateriality of information is very important. It means we cannot reduce information to physics and chemistry. Let me tell you a little story. We have a marvelous college in Oxford. I'm a fellow of Green Templeton College, and we put on lovely dinners. And unfortunately, sometimes the seat arrangements are fixed, so you can't adjust where you're sitting. So this night, I was sitting beside a biochemist, and he asked me what I did, and I was foolish enough to reply. I said, I'm a pure mathematician. Oh, he said, how dreadfully boring. And I said, oh, but I try to make up for it by being interested in the big questions of life. He said, like what? Well, I said, like the status of the universe. Is it created or not? Oh, dear, he said, it's far worse than I thought. He said, listen, the bottom line is this. I'm an atheist. I'm a reductionist. We're going to have an awful evening. We've nothing to talk about. And that's that. So what do you do with that? Well, I said to him, I said, you know, it's not all that bad, is it? I said, I mean, I'm fascinated by reductionism. I know at least three kinds. Which kind are you? Well, he wasn't quite sure. So being a kind man, I...
Does anybody know what reductionism is? Essentially, reductionists are people who believe that you can whittle all of life down to chemical processes. In other words, you can show and demonstrate that everything's just a product of chemistry and physics. That's reductionism. So essentially nothing above it really has any meaning. It's just everything's explained by the interaction of the laws of physics and chemistry. Gas and hot air, yeah.
To him a little bit, and I said, you're a methodological reductionist. You take a big problem, split it into little problems, solve the little problems, get insight onto the big problem. Yes, he said, I do that. Good, I said, we agree on that then. So he was warming up, called me by my first name, so we were getting on famously. And then I said, I think you're an ontological reductionist. That you believe ontos, Greek being, you believe everything can be reduced to physics and chemistry. He said, that's right, that's my basic principle. So I said, let's have an experiment then. He said, what, here at the table? I said, sure. So I picked up the menu. And he looked at it, and it wasn't very interesting. It said roast chicken, and not even in French, in English. And he said, what's the problem? I said, you're a reductionist. Everything in terms of physics and chemistry. I said, now look at this thing here, R, O. I said, those are marks, aren't they? But they're semiotic, Greek semion, a sign. They're marks that carry meaning. He said, that's right. Okay, I said. Explain to me the semiotics of those marks in terms of the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink. And there was a silence. And then his wife said a bit loudly, get out of that if you can.
So his challenge was, you know, he showed him letters, language. And he said, those letters mean something. They symbolize something. Explain that to me in terms of physics and chemistry, how physics and chemistry can generate language and meaning. And that's when his wife said, get out of that one if you can. Yeah.
He didn't try. I want to tell you what he said. Now, this is one of the world's top biochemists. He said, John, for 40 years I've gone into my laboratory thinking that that could be done. But it can't. I was so amazed, I backtracked. I said, oh, but science has only been going 500 years or so. He said, doesn't matter. You cannot explain the semiotics bottom up. You have to introduce an intelligence. And then it dawned on him that I wasn't bright enough to have thought of the argument. He said, where did you get that argument? I said, I borrowed it from a Nobel Prize winner. And I'm glad you laughed, ladies and gentlemen. It's interesting, isn't it? Just a few marks, and you instantly argue upwards and postulate mind. And we sit and look at the human genome. 3.7, is it, billion letters in exactly the right order in a four-letter chemical alphabet. Sophisticated because the levels of information are contained not only in the linear sequencing, but in the folding and in its relationship to the cell and all kinds of things. And we ask about its ultimate origin, chance and necessity. What? Chance of the laws of nature. We don't say that about print. What's the difference? Semiotics in both cases. Seems to me something very interesting is going on. And that semion, the evidence of meaning, our capacity. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, we are not only containers of text, we are producers of text. And that, to my mind, is great evidence that there is a transcendence beyond nature. The beginnings of supernature are already to be seen within you.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recording...
It was interesting he brought up the... We look at a book, and we immediately realize that there was a mind behind the book that developed the language that had meaning in the book, correct? And he essentially said there's no difference between a book and a human. A human is comprised of programming language that gives rise to the operation of the human being, which gives meaning. And he said, but the problem is, when you look at the obvious, people would rather say it was a process of random chance, which we demonstrated with what Ken Ham said, there is no evidence in science that matter ever produced one bit of information. And even if it could, we demonstrated that the odds of assembling one working protein by assembling the amino acids needed to form it is utterly impossible because of the task required. Does that make sense? Okay. We will leave it there. Heavy topic today. Thank you for staying with me. I had much more. I had some archaeology and some prophecy. What I'm going to do is I'm going to copy my notes, and I will give you my notes on that cover the. In fact, I think you already have a handout on archaeology. I put those back there. Okay, so you have those. Those go with the two slides that I have in the briefing, and then I will share with you my notes on prophecy. They're actually, when you look at the slides on prophecy, they're fairly self-explanatory. The one. I highlighted a few specific, and that's the thing we learn about biblical prophecy is they're very specific. When you look at people who read your palm, astrologers, their prophecies are very generic. But biblical prophecy must always be specific, and it must always come true, and it is always proven to come true. For example, one I wanted to highlight, Daniel pinpointed the date of Jesus Christ's ministry. He wrote in roughly 540 BC, he wrote that the ministry of the Messiah would start 483 years after the Persian king's decree for exiled, which was Cyrus, for the exiled Jews to return home in 458 BC. Christ's ministry began in roughly 26 AD, 483 years after Cyrus told the Jews, go home. So he pinpointed the Messiah's ministry. Isaiah referred to Persian King Cyrus by name. He said that Cyrus would conquer Babylon and Egypt in 539 to 525 BC. He prophesied of the events. Again, Isaiah referred to Cyrus by name and what he would do 150 years before Cyrus was born. And then, of course, the prophecies about Jesus. He fulfilled from 48 to more than 400 Old Testament prophecies. And the odds that one man would fulfill eight prophecies is 1 in 10 to the 17th power. In other words, I like to use this illustration. If you took a quarter and quarters, stacked them about 6 feet high across the entire state of Texas, and you put a scratch in one of them, the odds that one man could fulfill eight prophecies are the same odds that on the first try you could find that one quarter stacked 6 feet high across Texas, the one quarter with the scratch. Now imagine that Jesus fulfilled 400. The odds that one man could fulfill 48 prophecies is 1 times 10 to the 157. An event has zero plausibility at 1 times 10 to the 110. In other words, it's utterly impossible for any man other than through miraculous means to fulfill 48 prophecies specifically. So, the miracle of prophecy. Alrighty, we will end it there. Lots and lots and lots of evidence. We just scratched the surface over the last 3 days. I mean, literally scratched the surface over the scientific, archaeological, prophetic evidence for the validity of Scripture. Amen?